From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today,
equal justice under law. That's the way I've tried to be a lawyer and as a judge. Make those words meaningful.
The legacy of Judge Damon Keith.
And he's really one of the last giants that from the civil rights movement.
The college basketball corruption trial of an ex-sports agent exposing the cozy worlds of sneaker companies and college basketball.
UNLV, Patino at Louisville, Arizona, Kansas has been named. These are the least shocking names I've heard so far. Trust me on this one.
The history of Yemeni sailors on the Great Lakes.
They have been a part of the economy of this region for at least 70 years, and a major part of that economy. I mean, the coal that fires our factories in the state of Michigan is brought to these ports by Yemeni laborers.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He was the grandson of slaves. His father made $5 a day working at Ford's Rouge plant. Judge Damon Keith died Sunday morning at age 96. This Detroiter left his mark on United States history with a series of landmark decisions that changed the social and legal landscape of this country. In a PBS interview with Tavis Smiley, Judge Keith talked about growing up in Detroit.
Never had a black teacher. And the Fisher Y was right across from Northwestern High School. Blacks could not go to that Fisher Y. There wasn't a black police officer above the rank of sergeant. There were no black judges. There were no black elected officials.
Wayne State University law professor Peter Hammer is director of the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights and co-author of the 2013 book about Judge Keith, Crusader for Justice. Peter, what has this country lost with the passing of Damon Keith?
You know, you have these giants that you're privileged to walk with, and he's really one of the last giants that is here from the civil rights movement. You have one of the best and most important jurists this country has ever produced. And I think about the Northern Star. It's like looking out tonight at the skylight and not seeing that important fixture.
What motivated him to become a lawyer? What was his driving force?
It's all about justice. And there's a kind of funny story in the book. He was teetering on whether he wanted to pursue social work or become a lawyer. And thank God, not that social work doesn't produce tremendous benefits, but he became a judge because he, or a lawyer, and then a judge because he wanted to make the most impact in terms of getting justice, particularly for African American, but for other marginalized groups.
And of course, as we've been hearing, if we didn't know before, that reminding that he was a student of a very influential black judge while he was at Howard Law School, Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. How did Thurgood Marshall impact Damon J. Keith?
Yeah, so you've got to remember not just Thurgood Marshall, but Charles Hamilton Houston and that whole generation of lawyers were specifically trained at Howard University to dismantle Jim Crow segregation and to establish, as Thurgood Marshall would say, and Judge Keith would frequently report, those words on the Supreme Court building, equal justice under law, are going to be relevant to everybody. And Judge Keith tells a wonderful story oftentimes. He says, well, Thurgood said, the white man put those words on that wall, and we're going to make him live up to it. And that really defines the rest of Judge Keith's career.
And when you think of the mountains that Damon Keith had to climb to reach that place in legal history and always reminded of the color of his skin, am I right, even after he became a judge, didn't someone once just toss his car keys at Damon Keith, figuring he was the valet guy?
Yeah, and that underscores what Judge Keith would also often say, that not a day would go by in his life, that in some way, great or small, he wasn't reminded that he was black. And the story that you're telling, which is detailed in the biography, didn't just happen at any hotel. That happened in Williamsburg at a conference where the judge was the chair of the Bicentennial Committee to celebrate the 200th birthday of the Constitution. And after leaving an important meeting, he's going outside the door, and a white man throws his keys at the judge and says, hey, boy, park my car. And is that kind of lived reality that I think kept fueling his need to create justice for everybody.
U.S. Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals Judge Eric Clay, in a statement, called Judge Damon Keith, and I'm quoting, one of the most influential federal jurists of the 20th and 21st centuries. Peter, how did his work change the life of Americans in Michigan and beyond? Tell us some of his most impactful decisions.
Yeah, so you can't think of any important social issue. So you think about school and school segregation. Well, that was happening in the North as well, and he desegregated the Pontiac schools, and the KKK blew up school buses to prevent the busing from going into place. So these aren't safe decisions. It takes a lot of courage. You think about national security, and you think then about the Keith case that he said to President Nixon at the height of Nixon's popularity that you can't engage in wiretaps without a court-ordered warrant. And if you think about housing, right, it was in Hamtramck where the city of Hamtramck was going through a conscious policy of depopulation, but that was targeted exclusively at its African-American population. Or you think about the racial composition of police and police brutality, and he was there trying to ensure that there was affirmative action and equal racial representation in the Detroit police, or employment at DTE. So just it goes across the board. Almost any issue that you care about, there was a leading Keith opinion that was trailblazing in the way that it was trying to ensure greater equality in this country.
And speaking of trailblazing, Judge Keith is the longest serving black judge in this country's history. What did he say? Would he talk about what it meant to him to be that kind of a pioneer? How did he see his own legacy?
Yeah, at one level, it was incredibly humble. But he was also very self-conscious of history, and he knew what role he was playing in history. And one thing he did throughout his life was take incredibly good care of his health. I think he did that. This is my speculation, because he knew that the job was undone. And even after more than 50 years on the bench, if you look at the issues we're facing as a country, the work is still not done. And I think he would be the first to acknowledge that. And I think that was one of the things that kept him going to the office every day.
When you think of what he fought for over those 50 years, and then I'm wondering what he thought of, for example, Supreme Court decision, that 2013 Supreme Court decision in Shelby County v. Holder. I mean, these decisions stripping away voting rights protections he fought for.
Yeah. No, there is nothing that was more important to the judge than voting rights. And he knew people that had fought for that. He knew people who had lived and people who had died fighting for those voting rights. It just devastated him, that opinion. And one of the most important last dissents that he's famous for was in another voting rights case. And in the beginning of that opinion, he actually listed out with pictures every civil rights martyr who had died in the cause of fighting for voting rights. And he wanted his fellow judges on the panel, and he wanted the whole country to remember how sacred those voting rights are and that they can't be removed in the way that the Supreme Court is taking our jurisprudence.
Finally, what's your most special memory of Damon Keith?
Just what an amazing human being he was. And you hear that just repeatedly. Everybody who had an encounter with him, he treated you like you were the most important person in the world. And that would be true whether you were the President of the United States or whether you were mopping the floors. And just that notion of recognizing the deep humanity and dignity in every person he touched, to me, is my fondest memory. I often say that you can find great men who are not great men, and the judge is the opposite. He's a man who did amazing things, but at the same time, he was truly a great individual and a great humanitarian.
Peter Hammer is director of the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights, Wayne State University law professor, who's co-author of the biography of Judge Damon Keith, Crusader for Justice. Peter, thank you for your time. Thank you for talking with us.
My pleasure.
The Straits of Mackinac are known for clear blue water, strong currents, and a 5-mile-long suspension bridge. It's also one of the busiest migration spots for raptors, or birds of prey, in the United States. Michigan Radio's Kay LaFond was there and brings us this story.
Raptors are a group of birds that include hawks, eagles, and owls. Like many other birds, they have to migrate north and south with the seasons to find food and nesting locations. But they are not fans of large bodies of water.
They don't want to fly over water they can't see the other side of.
That's Richard Kaus. He's the executive director of the Mackinac Straits Raptor Watch, which counts the birds as they fly over.
that they're not like gulls, or they're not, so they land in the water, they're not going to make it out. So yeah, they try to find the path of least resistance.
If you're a raptor that needs to cross the Great Lakes, the Straits of Mackinac are that path. Mackinac City is like a raptor migration funnel. The Raptor Watch was formed in 2014 by a group of bird lovers who knew the Straits weren't getting the same scientific attention as other migration corridors in the U.S. And last year, the Straits of Mackinac broke a world record. 5,360 red-tailed hawks flew over on a single day during spring migration. Kaus says the Mackinac Straits Raptor Watch made that record possible.
Birds always been flying over, but because they were finally able to raise some grant money to actually hire somebody to be out there every day counting hawks, there was somebody there to witness it.
The official raptor counting site is behind Mackinac City Public Schools, right near some softball fields, and the public is invited to come observe. Serious raptor watching enthusiasts come from around the country, people like Russ Edmonds from Hartford City, Indiana.
A red-tailed hawk just went by back there. He's over the telephone pole there. Hey, Kevin, there's two behind you.
Kevin George leans out of his car door, binoculars in hand, partially protected from the bitterly cold winds. He records the two hawks on his data tablet. George is the official counter hired by the Mackinac Straits Raptor Watch. He's been a full-time raptor counter all over the country for 39 years.
So this is a seriously awesome migration corridor.
He says the Straits are one of the best hawk watching spots because there are so many. And it isn't just hawks.
This is like one of the premium places in the United States to see golden eagles. You can see up to like 300 in their adult golden eagles coming through a lot of years.
George says it's been kind of a slow day, but he rattles off his count.
We had 12 turkey vultures so far, one sharp shin, two red shoulders, eight red tails, and 50 sandhill cranes, and one American kestrel.
Rich Kaus, remember, he's the head of the Raptor Watch, says even though the Straits are the best spot to cross, it's still challenging for the birds.
So you'll be watching, and you'll see some of them actually turn around. Like, they get up the courage, like, I'm going to do this, and then like, oh, wait a second, I'm not going to do this today. I'll try again.
They'll rest and try again tomorrow. I'm Kay LaFond.
Coming up, the history of Yemeni sailors on the Great Lakes.
They have been a part of the economy of this region for at least 70 years, and a major part of that economy. I mean, the coal that fires our factories in the state of Michigan is brought to these ports by Yemeni laborers.
That story after the break. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Michigan is home to the nation's largest population of Yemeni Americans, somewhere north of 10,000. And what first brought Yemenis to Michigan? Well, for many, economic opportunity that could be found on the Great Lakes. There's a long but little-known history of Yemeni sailors on the Great Lakes. Sally Howell is an associate professor of history at the University of Michigan Dearborn, where she directs the Center for Arab American Studies. Sally, welcome back.
Thank you, Cindy. It's so good to be here.
And we welcome Jalal Albana. He is Yemeni American, and a year ago, he graduated from the Great Lakes Maritime Academy. So good to have you here, Jalal.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, Sally, take us back. Let's take that historical view. When people from Yemen first cast their eye toward the Great Lakes and decided they wanted to emigrate to cities like Detroit or cities like Buffalo, New York, when was this and why?
Well, that's actually the one question I don't have the answer to. We're still trying to figure out the point of origin of this narrative. We know that Yemenis, they were merchant marines working for the British Navy, starting when the British colonized the port of Aden. So this is a long history. And before the British got to Aden and colonized that port, it was part of their Indian Empire. The Yemeni sailors, especially from the Hadhramaut region of Yemen, they sort of dominated trade in the Indian Ocean.
So and they have 1,200 miles of coastline. So these
exactly.
are people that know the ocean.
Yeah, right. they knew the ocean, and they were the most experienced traders, the most experienced sailors. And this is how Islam actually spread to places like Indonesia. It was through these Indians who were intellectual elites as well as merchants and religious authorities all at the same time. So there's that history, which is very different from the narrative about Lebanese Americans or other groups coming to America. The Yemeni route to America actually goes through the Indian Ocean, not through the Mediterranean like everyone else's. So I don't know when it actually started. There are rumors that people were here as early as the 1880s. There are rumors that Henry Ford, as early as like the 1912, 1914, that period, already had an interest in Yemeni sailors. Like the British, Ford had these attitudes about people based on where they come from. So if you come from a tropical environment like Yemen or India, he thought that those people were best to work in the engine rooms of the ships because they were from these hot climates. They could shovel coal all day long. So that was the role that most of the Yemenis played for the British. They were like the Bangladeshi workers working for the British, the Lascars, they called them, who had this sort of very intense labor-oriented job where you worked in the bowels of the ship just shoveling coal all day long. So not the most pleasant job. But fast forward to the 20th century, and we see of the sailors that we've been interviewing for my class, most of them started coming to America in the 1950s. And when they came to America, they did not have good English skills. And at the time, if you wanted to work for Henry Ford or GM or any of the big three, you needed to be able to speak English or you couldn't get hired on the line. But they could get hired on the ships.
So that was the outlet.
That was the outlet. They started working on the ships.
And what was bringing them in the 1950s? I mean, we know that there's much turmoil today in Yemen. What was the driver of emigration in the 50s?
In the 50s, it was basically a lack of economic opportunity in Yemen. And it really heated up more in the 60s. There was a revolution in the 1960s, and they overthrew a ruler who had been something like a dictator, had really kept the country isolated from the rest of the world. And the economy of the countryside had received no investment at all. Education opportunities were very minimal. And so people needed work. They needed to support their families. And once they started coming to America, they found that even though they were not in high-income jobs here in America, they could send money home. And part of the reason people like the ships is because if traditionally the early immigrants who came were men. And if you're on a ship, your meals are taken care of. Your housing is taken care of. You have no expenses. All of your income you can just save and send right home to the village. So it was a very attractive job for them.
And so I'm interested, Jalal, what turned you to becoming a sailor on the Great Lakes?
I know a lot of people that have sailed or and that are currently sailing.
In your family? Do you have a family history of this?
I do. I have a few family members that are sailing. And friend of the family, I look at him like my uncle. I've known him since I was a little kid. He's sailed since, I want to say, 95. And mentioned it to my father. He's like, well, go ahead and talk to your uncle because I know he's been sailing for a long time. Maybe he can give you a few pointers and help you get where you need to go. So I went and I spoke with him and he told me, he's like, well, if you're really serious and you would really like to join this industry, he goes, you should go to school, get your education. I'm like, what entails with that? What is it that you got to do?
Where do I go and what do I learn?
Right.
Yeah.
So he told me to go to the Great Lakes Maritime Academy and that he had known somebody that is currently an instructor there. Contacted the academy, set up orientation date, went, spoke with them, and didn't look back.
Tell me about your job. What do you do?
So I'm a third assistant engineer. So an engineer essentially on board any ship is responsible for making sure that ship goes. A ship essentially is a pretty much a floating city on water. And we make and produce our own electricity. We use our own electricity. If you're sailing on the Great Lakes, you have an unlimited supply of fresh water. So there isn't really much that you have to do besides, you know, filter it and things like that. But when you're sailing oceans, you have an unlimited supply of salt water. So we have the machinery that we use, evaporator, and it helps, you know, distill the water, which essentially turns it into drinkable water. And that's one other thing that we are responsible for making water on the ship. You know, whether it's for cleaning dishes, whether it's for sanitary reasons, or whether it's for taking a shower, and most essentially for drinking, you know, so nobody dies of dehydration.
So it's keeping the ship running, keeping the water good, so you have to be good in many things.
Right.
Could you take the skills, Jalal, that you learned at the Great Lakes Maritime Academy, and could you also then do ocean vessels? Are they very applicable?
Yes. I've actually worked both on the Great Lakes, okay. And I've worked oceans. I just got back, actually, from an ocean-going ship about a month ago.
Okay.
So.
And are jobs available? Is this a good outlet for people who are not sure where they want to go and what they want to do, but gee, there are jobs on ships?
There are. There's tons of jobs. There's many vessels, whether it's on the Great Lakes or it's oceans. Lots of jobs available, and it just essentially depends on what is it that you like to do. A lot of people like to see the sun all the time. They want to watch the sunrise and they want to see the sunset. Those are going to be more for guys that are going to be oriented on the deck. Somebody like me, it doesn't really matter if there's sun out or not. I mean, I work in an engine room, so, you know, depending on the ship, you know, 20, 30 feet below water at all times when I'm working. So occasionally you get to see the stars and get to see the sun, but, you know, whether I see it or not, I don't trip.
So there are career prospects, and there's room for growth, there's room for promotions.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you have two categories when it comes to the personnel that are on board. Mm-hmm. You have your officers and you have your unlicensed personnel. And you can start from the bottom, deckhand, wiper. Deckhand is going to be for on deck, and then the wiper is going to be somebody that's working in the engine room, and they can advance all the way up to a captain if they're working on deck. And from the engine room side, you can start off at a wiper and work your way up to be a chief engineer.
If you just joined us, we're talking about the long but little-known history of Yemeni sailors on the Great Lakes as we talk with Sally Howell, who directs the Center for Arab American Studies at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and Jalal Albana, who is Yemeni American and is a sailor, does ocean and Great Lakes ships, and went to the Great Lakes Maritime Academy to get, is that a degree? Is that like a four-year degree that you
get? Yes, it is. Okay. It's a bachelor's in science and maritime engineering.
Now, Sally, I know every semester you have your students kind of do a big public history project, and this is what you're focusing on, Yemeni sailors in the Great Lakes. So what's the goal? What's the mission of this project?
So the class focuses on sort of a public history project. So we find something that has been not really written about very much in the literature, and then we do research on it. And then the end goal is for the students to produce some sort of public project with the work. So last year we created an exhibition on the history of Iraqi refugees in this area. This year we're working on this Yemeni project. And the final class project, they have to do their reveal to the public. We're inviting all the people we interviewed to come back in and see them and people from the public. They're working right now on a website. But over the summer, we're going to go to Maryland, where the Seafarers International Union has their headquarters, and we're going to interview people there. We're going to go to the National Archive and look into some immigration records so we can trace the early history of this. And the end goal will be we're going to add to the collection of the Arab American National Museum, which covers the history of Arab American culture, and we're going to make sure that they have a part of their museum that tells the story of Yemenis on the Great Lakes, because they have been a part of the economy of this region for at least 70 years, from what we've been able to document,
right,
at least 70 years.
If not longer, as you may find out.
Exactly, if not longer. And a major part of that economy. I mean, the coal that fires our factories in the state of Michigan is brought to these ports by Yemeni laborers. And
as well as the power plants.
I mean, it's amazing. The grain that moves through the lakes is moved by Yemeni labor.
Right.
What else are we moving around the Great Lakes?
One major resource that we haul is iron ore, which is one of the major components to steelmaking. And all the steel mills that are located, you know, in the basin of Lake Michigan, Cleveland over in Lake Erie, they all need the raw material, and we help move that raw material, essentially.
Yeah. So that's our purpose was just to, we understand that these people are contributing to the economy and it's a story that's not being told. So our goal is to do as much research as we can. We've interviewed 24 seafarers over the course of the summer. The students I'll be working with this summer hope to interview the wives and the children of the Yemeni seafarers, because this way of life is stressful for families.
I can imagine. I was wondering what it's like. I know you're the father of two.
Right.
How long are you typically gone?
It depends. When I'm working on the lakes, I'm usually doing relief work. So I go and I being pretty much like a substitute teacher. So there's an engineer who's already working on board and they have their permanent schedule. When they're ready to go off for vacation, I go in and I fill in for them. With that, you know, it takes some time to get seniority, I guess, with the company, and then you can get your own permanent position. But usually whenever it comes to the ocean, the trips are always going to be a little bit longer. For example, I just got back from Africa. It took 35 days to get to Africa. So that trip essentially was about 3 months. It all depends on where it is that you're going and how many loads you have to load or unload and things like that. But a normal trip when it comes to oceans is about 3 months.
And that, as you say, there's the family at home holding things together with the sailor gone.
And historically, the Yemenis, as I alluded to earlier, they tended to, at least when they first got here, they might spend 10 or 15 years where they worked here and their families were in Yemen. Mm. So they would only go to visit once a year or once every 2 or 3 years. So that was even more stressful. But in the 80s, really, people started bringing their families here. And that's why we have such a large community here, because now it's become a local community, not just a transnational community. Right. So it's a little bit less stressful than it used to be. Mm-hmm. And also, we're seeing real patterns in the early days. Life on board the ships was much harder than it is today. If your family's in Yemen and you're here, how are you communicating with your family? You know, through the mail, through the mail.
No Skype, no FaceTime, but now you've got that.
No FaceTime, right.
And it would take months for letters to come back and forth. And there are people who, and if you didn't have a home address, where would your mail go?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So there are all these people who tell a story. Some of the older sailors that we talked to, a big part of their narrative is telling us how they kept in touch with their families. You know, if they ever had a phone call, how they would arrange the phone call, because maybe their village didn't even have a phone. You know, people would have to drive to the city to call. Mm-hmm. It was things like that. Whereas today, these guys have Wi-Fi on many of the ships, and they can watch movies all night long. And, you know, not that they do, because they need to rest. But it's just the nature of the work has really shifted over the generations. It's become a little bit easier. And also, you go through a lot more training now. So I think the safety level has also increased for people on the lakes.
Plus, on the lakes, most of the time, you know, you're always within cell phone reception. So, I mean, unless you're making the trek across Lake Superior, there's probably a period of between 12 to 18 hours, maybe max, of not having any cell phone reception. So for the most part, a lot of the vessels on the lakes don't really have like Wi-Fi. They're very old vessels. Mm-hmm. I think the newest vessel on the lakes was made in 1981 or put into commission in 81. Mm-hmm. So very old. And they don't have that. You know, a lot of the vessels don't.
So you just need a good cell phone plan.
Good
cell phone plan.
I'm going to take advantage of the fact that you've been sailing on the ocean. You've sailed on the Great Lakes. And for most of the people hearing us talk right now, they know the Great Lakes from sitting on the beach on a sunny day, splashing in the waves, and enjoying that gentle experience. Give us a sense of what it is like to be way out there during a storm.
Ooh, quite nerve-wracking. It can be very frightening, actually. You see waves crashing over the deck, strong winds, and if you're in your bunk at the time, you're doing whatever you can to hold on so you don't fall off of your bunk, and making prayers that, you know, we stay above the water. It's quite an experience, to say the least. On the lakes, I've been fortunate. I haven't gotten to experience any of those really bad storms. I mean, smaller storms, you know, just rain, high
but
winds and everything.
The Edmund Fitzgerald kind of mega storms, you have not.
No. Yeah. And for the most part, just from what I've heard from people that have experienced that, you know, they're doing a lot to try to prevent ships from enduring that kind of weather. So, you know, they're doing their best to keep up on the technology with like the radar and the Doppler, and weather shifts relatively quick. So, you know, you got the guys working in the pilot house, you know, doing their best to make sure like, oh, okay, we see something brewing up. We might want to either check back, you know, wait to see if this is going to pass by, or, you know, drop the hook if it's looking really bad. And it helps keep us and everybody out of danger. And essentially, that's our lives at stake. I mean, to me, I think that's very valuable.
One of the people that we'd interviewed for the project was on the ship that passed through that strait right before the Edmund Fitzgerald. And he described that as the worst experience of his life. It was terrifying. It was clear that the waters were perilous. And they radioed back to say, you know, this is it. But the ship was already there. And then, you know, they kept calling and they weren't receiving a signal back. So they were the ones that alerted the Coast Guard. People are very aware of how dangerous the work is. And that's part of why, when I said they described it as a kind of prison, it's a very frightening place to be in a storm. And also, just the winter, I'll share some footage with you of just what it looks like to be on one of these ships going through a channel in the ice. It's sort of beautiful and mesmerizing because it's something that most people don't experience. Right. But it's also, it's...
Nerve-wracking.
Yeah, it's nerve-wracking. You're aware that that's ice and that ice has the power to destroy the ship if circumstances change.
Well, we all know the story of the Titanic.
Yes, so...
Indeed. What do you like most about the work you do on the lakes and on the ocean?
I got to say it's going to places that I've never been to before and places that I can say I probably would have never been there had I not been on a ship. Prime example, my last trip, I went to Africa. I went over to Mombasa, Kenya, and I went to Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. Two places I would never even contemplate, you know, going if I had the means or when I do have the means. It's just, it's not even a thought. So doing what I do, being able to work on the lakes and go on oceans, you know, I get to see places and get to meet new people and experience things that without doing what I do for a career, I would have never been able to experience.
Sally, I know you say ultimately all this body of work you and your students are doing as you kind of dig into the history of Yemeni Americans on the Great Lakes, it will go to the Arab American Museum. How important is that museum in sharing the history not only of Yemeni sailors, but of the contributions of Arab Americans?
There's nothing like it in the country. I mean, it's a wonderful institution. The Arab American community is old, it's diverse, it's large, it's dynamic. It's been an important part of the history of this region, clearly. It's also an important community nationally. And it's a community that I think is really misunderstood, especially in this political climate. So I'm just so happy that the museum is there and they're able to tell the stories of a whole variety of different kinds of Arab Americans. And this one little snippet of Yemeni history here in Michigan is critical to what they do.
We'll look forward to seeing all of that on exhibit eventually at the museum. We've been talking with University of Michigan Dearborn History Professor Sally Howell and Great Lakes sailor Jalal Albana. Thank you so much for sharing your life and your work with us and your passion for history. It was great to talk with you.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you, Cindy.
And this is a mighty good time to remind you that we will be doing Stateside in Dearborn this coming Thursday evening, and we would love to have you there in our audience at the Arab American National Museum. I'll have all the details for you at the end of today's show. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It is time to check in with Michigan Radio sports commentator John U. Bacon. And boy, John, a lot of emotion on full display during the NFL draft. I have to say, I don't care who the player is and what team he's going to. It is hard to top the sheer excitement and joy of these players and the parents who get that phone call and they realize all those years of hard work paid off.
It's incredible. And what's incredible is this thing was not televised until pretty recently.
Yeah.
Archie Manning, Peyton and Eli Manning's father, when he was at Ole Miss, they showed up before his class, showed him a New Orleans Saints jersey, took a photo, and then he went to class. There was none of this. And now this is like killer TV where they spread it out into 3 days.
See, a huge crowds to watch. It is something.
Think about this, too. They're paying money to watch a middle-aged man get up there and announce a name. That's, I mean, as drama goes, you wouldn't think it's a lot, but it does play.
Indeed. Well, so the Lions scooped up 9 new players in their 2019 draft class, and that first-round pick is tight end T.J. Hockenson out of Iowa. So what are your thoughts, pro and con, of how the Lions did?
On the pro side, T.J. Hockenson is considered by far the best tight end in the country. Detroit needs one. Matt Patricia is from the New England Patriots, where Gronkowski was their legendary all-pro tight end, Tom Brady's favorite receiver for a long, long time. So he's trying to rebuild the Patriots in Detroit. Flip side is, in 50 years of this, with 10 top 10 picks, that's 500 top 10 picks, only 13 tight ends have been picked, probably the fewest of any position, 2.6%. And 3 of them have been by the Lions, which tells you this is considered a fool's bet by other observers. So we'll see how it works out. Great tight end. The question is, could you get him in the second or third round? That's always the bet you're doing during the draft. So that said, they also got a lot of great help with defensive backs on the defense generally. And they're given about a B-plus overall by most prognosticators.
You think the Lions are better off today than a week ago before the draft?
Yes, because they sucked a week ago.
So when you think of players out of Michigan, are Michigan schools any surprises for you where players wound up?
Sure. I think that the Big Ten, by and large, did pretty well. They're in this never-ending battle with the South, and the South tends to win due to all kinds of natural advantages. But Michigan State had 2 players picked in the 3rd and 4th rounds, both defensive backs. When actually the lack of players that get drafted from Michigan State shows me what a great job D'Antonio does without a ton of star power. Whereas Michigan's got 5 picked, And they did quite well, of course. The shock on the Michigan side was Rashawn Gary, a third-year player out of New Jersey. He was picked anywhere between 2nd and 10th, they thought. But right before the draft, two things came out, both negatives. One, does his right shoulder, the labrum, need surgery on it, which he'd been kind of nursing all last season. And two, the Wonderlic score is the NFL's IQ, basically. And somebody leaked, some cruel, and we don't know if it's even accurate, person leaked that he got a 9 out of 25, which is obviously not high. But he is dyslexic, was diagnosed in 7th grade. He's an academic all-Big Ten player. Mm-hmm. 3 years in a row. So he has worked very hard to work with this. So that was cruel. So those two things, people thought he might not even be in the first round, which costs you millions. And in fact, he was picked 12th. So his story worked out quite well. Green Bay Packers are a great organization, only like 5 in the NFL that I think are great. And before him, another surprise, Devin Bush Jr., the son of Devin Bush Sr., who went 26th overall when he was drafted by the Falcons way back when. His son went 10th, got nice. Jumped from 20 to 10 by the Pittsburgh Steelers. He's also academic All-Big Ten, so two great stories there.
I want to get your thoughts about the news this past week coming out of the college basketball corruption trial of ex-sports agent and a Michigan native named Christian Dawkins, also an ex-Adidas consultant. And mm-hmm. it's his second trial, right, stemming from this probe into this cozy world of sneaker companies and college basketball. He was sentenced in March to 6 months. Second trial began last week. So what is this all about?
It's about corruption. It's about what we've basically always known has been going on, but now it's being proven. I am frankly hopeful that some coaches I know who are phony do-gooders and are not get taken down, and not talking about the Big Ten here, just so you know. This guy's naming names. He's got not much to lose. It's his second trial, after mm-hmm. all. But he has pointed out, as you and I have discussed, the Bowen story. Go ahead with this one.
Well, last Wednesday, the court heard this video recording. He brags about paying coaches and athletes, ties to top coaches. He had a text message with a list of 6 head coaches he was going to reach out to. To quote the text, "These are my main guys." Louisville's Rick Pitino and UNLV's Marvin Menzies, they were on that head coach list. They've both been fired. Arizona's Sean Miller was number 1 on the list, and MSU's Tom Izzo was on the list. What do I make from that? But first trial, the recruitment of Saginaw star Brian Bowen, that was involved in Dawkins' lawyer said Michigan State was one of the only schools that was not going to pay for Brian Bowen to go there. And he said MSU was one top program that didn't violate rules.
So we'll see what happens next. Look, UNLV, Pitino at Louisville, Arizona, Kansas has also been named. These are the least shocking names I've heard so far. Trust me on this one. So this now fits into the gap that we sports journalists deal with a lot, which is the gap between what you know and what you can prove, which is not the same thing. We have known this for a long time. Mm-hmm. I'd be surprised if Izzo is named. Apparently, there's some stirrings there, so we'll see what happens next. But Bowen is a guy he thought he had to the very end. At the last second, he goes somewhere else, which usually is a sign that okay. someone has given you a bag of money.
And we should say, on that list, there, as they presented it in court, the list did not show whether any coaches were paid or whether Dawkins actually even talked to them. So, you know, but he called them my main guys.
And here's the next question is, okay, it's not hard to pick off a dirty player with a dirty agent. You got 85 scholarship football players every year. You got, you know, 15 or so, 12 scholarship basketball players. So it's not hard to do that. The question always is, does the money go through the coaches? Are they aware of it? Do they tacitly approve of it? Have they arranged this? Because one is a 20-year-old doing something stupid. The other is a corrupt 50-year-old coach. Big difference.
And so as this trial proceeds, what are you going to watch for?
Just that. Where the fingerprints are. Follow the money. Still holds.
Michigan Radio Sports Commentator, John Ubig. And John, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The flower known as baby's breath may be a lovely touch to a bridal bouquet or a vase of long-stemmed roses. But when scientists and researchers see baby's breath flourishing on coastal sand dunes, they shudder. That's because baby's breath is a poster child for invasive plants that can wreck the ecosystem. Charlene Partridge is an assistant professor at the Annis Water Resources Institute at Grand Valley State. She recently did a study trip about baby's breath and its wily DNA. Welcome.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Why is baby breath so bad for coastal dunes?
Well, specifically in the coastal dune system, what happens is it is a very good proliferator. So for each plant, it produces roughly 14,000 seeds.
Well.
right. And within our greenhouse experiments, we show that they have relatively high germination success. So a lot of the seeds that are actually produced will actually produce baby's breath plants. And so what happens is within the dune system, this plant pretty much crowds out native species because for the native species, they produce a lot lower number of seeds per plant. Specifically, one of the plants that we're particularly concerned about is pitcher's thistle. So for those plants, each individual one will produce roughly 50 to 200 seeds. And when you compare that to the 14,000 seeds that baby's breath produces, you can just see that over time, baby's breath would pretty much swamp out that area.
And how have we seen baby's breath impact Michigan's dunes?
So what we've seen is in areas where we have higher concentrations of baby's breath or higher densities of baby's breath, we have lower numbers of native species. We also see it taking over habitat for things like piping plovers, the federally threatened birds that nest along the Lake Michigan dune system. So that's pretty much one of the major factors that we're concerned about is how it affects these native animals and flora.
And you took this research road trip with GVSU grad student Sarah Lamar. So where'd you go? What was the mission? And what did you learn about the DNA of baby's breath?
So one of the things that we found roughly last year is we were looking at the population structure of baby's breath along Michigan's dunes. And one thing that we found is that it's really, really weird. So the populations that are around Sleeping Bear and kind of south to Sleeping Bear National Lakeshore are really, really different than the populations that are north of like Traverse City and the Petoskey Dunes area. And we knew that their populations of baby's breath, particularly in the Pacific Northwest, that's another area where populations have high density and are really concentrated. So we just kind of wanted to see how these populations are connected to one another. So Sarah and I last year took a trip. We specifically were going toward a population in Washington State that we also look at. So we collected plants from Minnesota, North Dakota. We have populations from Iowa and then two populations in Washington State. And interestingly, what we found is that the populations that are in Michigan or in that Petoskey Dunes area are actually genetically more similar to populations in Washington State than they are to populations in Sleeping Bear Dunes.
Huh. Why is that, do you think?
So we think it might just be because of when these populations were initially established. So we know that the populations in Washington established in the late 1920s, and our earliest herbarium records of populations in Petoskey Dunes are from the early 1900s, so around 1915. So we think it may just be that around that time there may have been a limited number of seed distributors. So they all kind of came from the same seed distributor, whereas in Sleeping Bear Dunes, those populations didn't really take off to the late 1940s and 1950s after baby's breath became really popular as a floral bouquet flower. So during that time, you could have had a larger variety of seed distributors to choose from.
Got it. So from the research you're doing, how can that help contribute to the knowledge of how to control the spread of baby's breath? I mean, I'm wondering if what you learn could be put to use by, let's say, the rangers at the Sleeping Bear Dunes.
Right. So one of the things that this data helped us look at is to kind of see how these populations are kind of moving throughout the dune landscape. And that's one of the things that we're working on right now. So we're developing this landscape model to identify pockets of seed dispersal resistance so we can kind of identify corridors of high dispersal that they can use to actually target those locations for management. If you know that a high number of seeds are dispersing through this area, then maybe you need to focus more on that area in terms of your management. And then also understanding how populations are connected. If we know population one and population two has high number of seeds that are dispersing between them, then if you manage population one, you also need to manage population two, or otherwise they'll just pass seeds back and forth to one another. You won't necessarily actually be able to get rid of those populations if they're highly connected.
So more research needed. But a final quick question. What's your advice for backyard gardeners? Would you say steer clear of growing baby's breath?
I would definitely say steer clear of growing baby's breath. It's a little bit different between what you plant in your garden and what you buy. And the baby's breath in the flower shop tends to be harvested before it goes to seed, so that really isn't an issue. But the way this plant can proliferate and grow throughout, especially in our areas where you have sandy soil in the dune system, I would definitely suggest to kind of steer clear from baby's breath and try to focus more on local species.
Sharlyn Partridge, Assistant Professor at the Annis Water Resources Institute at GVSU. Great talking with you. Thank you for sharing your work with us.
Thank you so much.
Award-winning Michigan poet Jack Riddle has a new collection out. It's called St. Peter and the Goldfinch. Our reviewer Keith Taylor says the West Michigan wordsmith explores a necessary and often overlooked subject, getting old.
Jack Riddle taught for several decades at Hope College in Holland, Michigan. He was a tremendously successful professor of literature and creative writing. He won state and national awards for his teaching. He left a legacy that most people would have been proud of and would be satisfied with. But all during those years of teaching, Riddle kept working on his poetry, finding a way through the craft that suited his personality. His poems told small stories about ordinary life, suggesting larger issues that reached past the personal toward big subjects. His poems were very clean, uncluttered by any excess verbal baggage, and spoke directly to their readers. Unlike many other writer teachers, when Riddle retired from his day job, he became even more prolific. He kept many of the techniques he had mastered earlier, but his subject matter became noticeably different. Riddle has become one of the few poets we have who writes interesting poems about aging. It might not be a fashionable subject, but it is a necessary one. In St. Peter and the Goldfinch, Riddle has a wonderful sequence of poems called Suite for the Long Married. In one of the poems there, he describes a simple morning in the life of the older couple he writes about. There is this quiet, this way the day has of being where we belong. At precisely 7:45, the bells of St. Peter's will send an old hymn into the quiet, and we who are still pilgrims will then walk our way into another day. The religious element in that poem shows another aspect of the work in St. Peter and the Goldfinch that gives this book its power and helps to make it unique. Many of the poems included here sound like prayers. Quiet, uncertain prayers directed toward a God the poet isn't quite positive about. In an earlier poem in the same sequence about the long married, Riddle writes, "We will be religious without faith or doubt. The trees will be our amen. The cedar waxwings at the feeder will take our place at communion, redeeming seed into flight and song. Tonight, with the moon's generosity, we will gather the vestments for tomorrow." And that quiet space, where the trees will be our amen, is almost enough for those of us who are still pilgrims, and who might find the need for poems like these Jack Riddle has written in the daily lives we struggle through.
That was writer Keith Taylor with his review of West Michigan poet Jack Riddle's latest collection, St. Peter and the Goldfish Finch. Do you ever wonder how we do a stateside show? Well, this is your chance to find out. We have a special invitation for you. Come be in our audience when Stateside goes on the road. We're going to be doing Stateside from the stunning Arab American National Museum in Dearborn this coming Thursday, May 2nd at 7 p.m. Trust me, we have a lot of interesting guests lined up. We have music. We will have a comedian. And we are all excited to meet you. It is free. So just let us know if you're coming and how many of you will be in the party by going to michiganradio.org. You'll find the link to register. And the whole Stateside team is looking forward to seeing you Thursday, May 2nd, 7 p.m. at the Arab American National Museum in Dearborn. Today's Stateside was directed by Mike Blank and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joel Lindstroth. Today's contributors are April Van Buren, Sarah Leeson, Adam Reyes, Bella Isaacs, Rosie Joffrey, and Mercedes Mejia. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.